street behind the hotel, Georgia tried to banish Alan from her thoughts, but he remained at center stage. The bastard. With his current bedmate, an airhead blonde bearing the unlikely name Pepper, he had flown off to Acapulco for a week, not even bothering to leave a Christmas gift for Marcy. What did you tell a 7-year-old girl when she asked why her daddy didn't buy her anything for Christmas, or even come to see her? Although Alan left Georgia saddled with bills, she had willingly foregone alimony because by then she loathed him so much that she had not wanted to be dependent on him. However, she had gone after child support and had been shocked when he countered by insisting Marcy was not his child and therefore not his responsibility. Damn him! Georgia had married him when she was 19 and he was 24, and she'd never been unfaithful. Alan knew she hadn't cheated, but protecting his jazzy lifestyle, he needed every dollar for clothes, fast cars, and women, was more important to him than his wife's reputation or his daughter's happiness. To spare little Marcy humiliation and pain, Georgia had released Alan from responsibility before he could voice his sleazy accusations in the courtroom. So she was finished with him. She could put him out of her mind. But as she drove past the mall at the intersection of Maryland Parkway and Desert Inn Road, Georgia thought about how young she had been when she tied herself to Alan. Too young for marriage, and too naive to see through his facade. When she was 19, she thought he was très sophisticated, charming. For more than a year, their union had seemed blissful, but gradually she began to see him for what he was. Shallow, vain, lazy, a shockingly promiscuous womanizer. The summer before last, when their relationship had been rocky, she had tried to salvage the marriage by coercing Alan into a carefully planned 3-week vacation. She believed that part of their problem was that they spent too little time together. He was a baccarat dealer in one hotel and she was employed in another, and they frequently worked different shifts, slept on different schedules. Just the two of them and Marcy, embarking upon an adventurous 3-week car trip, seemed a good way to repair their damaged relationship. Unfortunately, but predictably, her scheme had not worked. After the vacation, upon their return to Vegas, Alan had been more promiscuous than before. He seemed determined, driven, to take a poke at anything in skirts. In fact, it was almost as if the car trip had somehow pushed him over the edge, for the number and intensity of his one-night stands developed a manic quality, a frightening desperation. 3 months later, in October of that year, he walked out on her and Marcy. The only good thing about the car trip had been the brief encounter with that young woman doctor who had been driving cross-country from Stanford to Boston on, she had said, her first vacation ever. Georgia still remembered the woman's name, Ginger Weiss. Although they had met only once, and then for little more than an hour, Ginger Weiss had quite unwittingly changed Georgia's life. The doctor had been so very young, so slender, pretty, feminine, it had been difficult to accept that she was really a doctor. Yet she'd been uncommonly self-assured and competent. Deeply impressed by Ginger Weiss during that encounter, Georgia was later motivated by the doctor's example. She had always thought of herself as a born cocktail waitress, incapable of anything more challenging. But when Alan walked out, she had remembered Dr. Weiss and decided to make more of herself than she had previously thought possible. During the past 11 months, Georgia had taken business management courses at UNLV, squeezing them into an already hectic schedule. When she finished paying the bills that Alan had left her, she would build a nest egg so she could eventually open her own business, a dress shop. She had worked out a very detailed plan, revising and honing it until it was realistic, and she knew she would stick with it. It was a shame that she would never have a chance to thank Ginger Weiss. Of course, it was not any favor that Dr. Weiss had performed that so deeply affected Georgia. It was not so much what the doctor had done as what she was. Anyway, at 27, Georgia's prospects were more exciting than they had been previously. Now she turned off Desert Inn Road onto Pawnee Drive, a street of comfortable homes behind the Boulevard Mall. She stopped in front of Kara Persagian's house and got out of the car. The front door opened before she reached it, and Marcy rushed out into her arms, shouting happily, "Mommy! Mommy!" And Georgia was at last able to forget about her job, the Texan, the argument with the pit boss, and the dilapidated condition of the Chevette. She squatted down and hugged her daughter. When all else failed to cheer her, she could count on Marcy for a lift.
"Mommy," the girl said, "did you have a great day?"
"Yes, honey, I did. You smell like peanut butter."
"Cookies. Aunt Kara made peanut butter cookies. I had a great day, too. Mommy, do you know why elephants came, why they came all the way from Africa to live in this country?"
Marcy giggled.
"'Cause we got orchestras here, and elephants just love to dance."
She giggled again.
"Isn't that silly?"
Even allowing for maternal prejudice, Georgia knew that Marcy was an adorable child. The girl had her mother's hair, so dark brown that it was virtually black, and her mother's dusky complexion. Her eyes were a striking contrast to the rest of her, not brown like Georgia's, but blue like her father's. She had an immensely appealing gamin quality. Marcy's huge eyes opened wide.
"Hey, know what day it is?"
"I sure do.
Almost.
Christmas Eve." "We'll be soon as it's dark, and Kara's giving us cookies to take home. You know, Santa's already left the North Pole, and he started going down chimneys already, but in other parts of the world, of course, where it's dark, not chimneys here. And Kara says I've been so bad all year, I'll only get a necklace made out of coal, but she's just teasing. Isn't she just teasing, Mommy?"
"Just teasing," Georgia confirmed.
"Oh, no, I'm not," Kara Persagian said.
She came through the doorway onto the front walk, a grandmotherly woman in a house dress and apron.
"A coal necklace, and maybe a set of matching coal earrings."
Marcy giggled again. Kara was not Marcy's aunt, merely her after-school babysitter. Marcy called her Aunt Kara from the second week she knew her, and the sitter was obviously delighted by that affectionately bestowed honorary title. Kara was carrying Marcy's jacket, a big coloring book picture of Santa that they had been working on for a few days, and a plate of cookies. Georgia gave the picture and jacket to Marcy, accepted the cookies with expressions of gratitude and with some chatter about diets, and then Kara said,
"Georgia, could I speak with you a moment? Just the two of us?"
"Sure."
Georgia sent Marcy to the car with the cookies and turned inquisitively to Kara.
"It's about Marcy. What's she done?"
"Oh, nothing bad. She's an angel, that one. Couldn't misbehave if she tried. But today... well, she was talking about how the thing she wants most for Christmas is that little Miss Dr. Plaguet...
It's the first time she's ever really nagged me about a toy," Georgia said. "I don't know why she's obsessed with it. She talks about it every day. You are getting it for her?"
Georgia glanced at the Chevette, confirming that Marcy was out of earshot, then smiled.
"Yes, Santa definitely has it in his bag."
"Good. She'd be heartbroken if you didn't.
But the oddest thing happened today, and it made me wonder if she'd ever been seriously ill."
"Serious illness?"
"No, she's an exceptionally healthy kid."
"Never been in the hospital?"
"No." "Why?"
Kara frowned.
"Well, today she started talking about the little Miss Doctor kit, and she told me she wanted to be a doctor when she grew up because then she could treat herself when she got sick. She said she never wanted a doctor to touch her again because she was once hurt real bad by doctors. I asked her what she meant, and she got quiet for a while, and I thought she wasn't going to answer me. Then finally, in this very somber voice, she said some doctors had once strapped her down in a hospital bed so she couldn't get out, and then they stuck her full of needles and flashed lights in her face and did all sorts of horrible things to her. She said they hurt her real bad, so she was going to become her own doctor and treat herself from now on."
"Really?"
"Well, it's not true,"
Georgia said.
I don't know why she'd make up such a story. That is odd. Oh, that's not the odd part. When she told me all this, I was concerned. I was surprised you'd never told me. I mean, if she'd been seriously ill, I ought to have been told in case there was a possibility of a recurrence. So I questioned her about it, just casually, the way you coax things out of a child. And suddenly, the poor little thing just burst into tears. We were in the kitchen, making cookies, and she started to cry and shake, just shaking like a leaf. I tried to calm her, but that only made her cry harder. Then she pulled away from me and ran. I found her in the living room, in the corner behind the big green lazy boy, huddled down as if she were hiding from someone.
Good heavens, Georgia said.
Took me at least 5 minutes to get her to stop crying, and another 10 to coax her out of her hidey-hole behind that chair. She made me promise, if those doctors ever came for her again, that I'd let her hide behind the chair and not tell them where she was. I mean, Georgia, she was in a real state.
On the way home, Georgia said, "Oh, that was some story you told Kara."
"What story?"
Marcy asked, looking straight ahead, barely able to see over the dashboard.
"That story about the doctors?" "Oh, being strapped in bed. Why'd you make up a thing like that?"
"It's true."
"But it isn't." "Yes, it is."
The girl's voice was little more than a whisper.
"The only hospital you were ever in was the one where you were born, and I'm sure you don't remember that."
Georgia sighed.
"A few months ago we had a little talk about fibbing. Remember what happened to Danny Duck when he fibbed?"
"The truth fairy wouldn't let him go to the woodchuck's party?"
"That's right."
"Fibbing's bad,"
Marcy said softly.
"Nobody likes fibbers, especially not woodchucks and squirrels."
Disarmed, Georgia had to bite back a laugh and struggle to keep a stern tone in her voice.
"Nobody likes fibbers."
They stopped at a red traffic light, but Marcy still looked straight ahead, refusing to meet Georgia's eyes. The girl said,
"It's especially bad to fib to your mommy or your daddy,
or to anyone who cares about you. And making up stories to scare Kara, that's the same as fibbing."
"Wasn't trying to scare her,"
Marcy said.
"Trying to get sympathy, then. You were never in a hospital."
"Was."
"Oh, yeah?"
Marcy nodded vigorously, and Georgia said,
"When?" "Don't remember when."
"You don't remember, huh?"
"Almost."
"Almost isn't good enough."
"Where was this hospital?" "I'm not sure. Sometimes I remember it better than other times. Sometimes I can hardly remember it at all, and sometimes I remember it real good, and then I get scared."
"Right now you don't remember too well, huh?"
"Nope. But today I remembered real good and scared myself."
The traffic light changed, and Georgia drove in silence, wondering how best to handle the situation. She had no notion what to make of it. It was foolish ever to believe that you understood your child. Marcy had always been able to surprise Georgia with actions, statements, big ideas, musings and questions that seemed not to have come from within herself, but which it seemed she had carefully selected from some secret book of startling behavior that was known to all kids but not to adults. Some cosmic volume, perhaps titled, "Keeping Mom and Dad Off Balance." As if she had just dipped into that book again, Marcy said,
"Why were all Santa Claus's kids deformed?"
"What?"
"Well, see, Santa and Mrs. Claus had a whole bunch of kids, but all of them was elves."
"The elves aren't their children. They work for Santa."
"Really? How much does he pay them?"
"Well, he doesn't pay them anything, honey."
"How do they buy food, then?"
"They don't have to buy anything. Santa gives them all they need."
This was certainly the last Christmas that Marcy would believe in Santa. Nearly all of her classmates were already doubters. Recently, she had been asking these probing questions. Georgia would be sorry to see the fantasy disproved, the magic lost.
The elves are part of his family, honey, and they work with him simply for the love of it.
You mean the elves are adopted? So Santa doesn't have real kids of his own? That's sad.
No, 'cause he's got all the elves to love.
God, I love this kid, Georgia thought. Thank you, God. Thank you for this kid, even if I did have to get tied up with Alan Rykoff to get her. Dark clouds and silver linings.
She turned into the two-lane driveway that encircled Los Huevos Apartments and parked the Chevette in the fourth carport. Los Huevos. The eggs. After 5 years in the place, she still couldn't understand why anyone would name an apartment complex the eggs. The instant the car stopped, Marcy was out of it with the poster from the coloring book and the plate of cookies dashing up the walkway to their entrance. The girl had deftly changed the subject just long enough to finish the ride and escape from the confines of the car. Georgia wondered if she should press the issue farther. It was Christmas Eve, and she had no desire to spoil the holiday. Marcy was a good kid, better than most, and this business about being hurt by doctors was an extremely rare instance of fabrication. Georgia had made the point that fibbing was not acceptable, and Marcy had understood, even if she had persisted a bit with her medical fantasy, and her sudden change of subject had probably been an admission of wrongdoing. So it was an aberration. Nothing would be gained by harping on it, especially not at the risk of ruining Christmas. Georgia was confident she would hear no more about it. Five. Laguna Beach, California. During the afternoon, Dominic Corvaces must have read the unsigned typewritten note 100 times. The sleepwalker would be well advised to search the past for the source of his problem. That is where the secret is buried. In addition to the letter's lack of signature and return address, the postmark on the plain white envelope was double-struck and badly smeared, so he could not determine whether it had been mailed in Laguna Beach or from another city. After he paid for his breakfast and left the cottage, he sat in his car, the copy of Twilight in Babylon forgotten on the seat beside him, and read the note 6 times. It made him so nervous that he withdrew a pair of Valiums from his jacket pocket and almost took one without water. But as he put the tablet to his lips, he hesitated. To explore all of the ramifications of the note, he would need a clear mind. For the first time in weeks, he denied himself chemical escape from his anxieties. He returned the Valium to his pocket. He drove to South Coast Plaza, a huge shopping mall in Costa Mesa, to buy some last-minute Christmas gifts. In each store he visited, while he waited for the clerks to gift-wrap his purchases, he took the curious message from his pocket and read it again and again. For a while, Dom had wondered if the note had come from Parker, if perhaps the artist had sent it to jolt him and intrigue him and propel him out of his drug-induced haze. Parker might be capable of such highly theatrical, amateur psychotherapy. But finally, Dom dismissed that idea. Machiavellian maneuvers were simply not aspects of the painter's personality. He was, in fact, almost excessively forthright. Parker was not the author of the note, but he was certain to have some original speculations about who might be behind it. Together they might be able to decide just how the arrival of this letter changed things and how they ought to proceed. Later, back in Laguna, when Dom was within a block of Parker's house, he was suddenly shaken by a previously unconsidered, profoundly troubling possibility. This new idea was so disconcerting that he pulled the Firebird to the curb and stopped. He got the note from his pocket, read it again, fingered the paper. He felt cold inside. He looked into the reflection of his own eyes in the rearview mirror, and he did not like what he saw. Could he have written the note himself? He could have composed it on the display writer while asleep. But it was outlandish to suppose he had dressed, gone to the mailbox, deposited the note, returned home, and changed into pajamas again without waking up? Impossible. Wasn't it? If he had done such a thing, his mental imbalance was worse than he had thought. His hands were clammy. He blotted them on his trousers. Only three people in the world were aware of his sleepwalking. Himself, Parker Fane, and Dr. Koblatz. He had already eliminated Parker. Dr. Koblatz had certainly not sent the note. So if Dom himself had not sent it, who had? When he pulled away from the curb at last, he did not continue to Parker's house, but headed home instead. 10 minutes later, in his study, he took the by-now rumpled note from his pocket. He typed those two sentences, which appeared on the display writer's dark screen in glowing green letters. Then he switched on the printer and instructed the computer to produce a hard copy of the document. He watched as it hammered out those 23 words. The display writer came with 2 print wheels in 2 typefaces. He had bought 2 more to provide options for different tasks. Now, Dom used the 3 additional print wheels to produce a total of 4 copies of the note, and with a pencil he labeled each according to the style of type used for it. Prestige Elite, Artisan 10, Courier 10, Letter Gothic. He smoothed out the original rumpled note and placed each of the copies beside it for comparison. He hoped to eliminate all 4 type styles that he possessed, disproving the theory that he had sent the note to himself. But the Courier 10 appeared to be a perfect match. That did not conclusively prove he'd written the note. In offices and homes all over the country, there must be millions of print wheels and printer elements in the Courier face. He compared the paper of the original note to that of the copy he had made. They were both 20-pound, 8.5 by 11, standard products sold under a dozen labels in thousands of stores in all 50 states. Neither sheet was of sufficient quality to contain fibers. Dom held them up to the light and saw that neither page featured a mill seal or brand name watermark, which might have proven that the original note had not been typed on paper from his own stock. He thought, Parker, Dr. Koblatz, and me. Who else could know? And what was the note trying to tell him, exactly? What secret was buried in his past? What suppressed trauma or forgotten event lay at the root of his somnambulism? Sitting at his desk, staring at the night beyond the big window, straining blindly toward understanding, he grew tense. Again, he felt a need for Valium, almost a craving, but he resisted. The note engaged his curiosity, logic, and reason. He was able to focus his intellect on the search for a solution and concentrate with an intensity of which he had not been capable recently, and thus he found the willpower to forsake the solace of tranquilization. He was beginning to feel good about himself for the first time in weeks. In spite of the helplessness in which he had been wallowing, he now realized that, after all, he still had the power to shape and direct the course of his own life. All he had needed was something like the note, something tangible on which he could focus. He paced around the house, carrying the note, thinking. Eventually, he came to a front window from which he could see his curbside mailbox, a brick column with a metal receptacle mortared into it, standing in the bluish fall of light from a mercury vapor street lamp. Because he kept the post office drawer in town, the only mail he got at home was that addressed to Occupant, and occasional cards or letters from friends who had both his mailing and street address, but who sometimes forgot that all correspondence was to go to the former. Standing at the window, staring at the curbside receptacle, Dom realized that he had not picked up today's delivery. He went outside, down the front walk to the street, and used a key to unlock the receptacle. Except for the breeze that rustled the trees, the night was quiet. The wind carried the scent of the sea, and the air was chilly. The overhead mercury vapor lamp was sufficiently bright for Dom to identify the mail as he withdrew it from the box. 6 advertising flyers and catalogs, 2 Christmas cards, and a plain white
business-size envelope with no return address. Excited, fearful, he hurried back into the house to his study, tearing open the white envelope and extracting a single sheet of paper as he went. At his desk, he unfolded the letter. The moon. No other words could have shocked him as badly as those. He felt as if he had fallen into the white rabbit's hole and was tumbling down into a fantastic realm where logic and reason no longer applied. The moon. This was impossible. No one knew he had awakened from bad dreams with those words on his lips, repeating them in panic. The moon. Moon. And no one knew that while sleepwalking he had typed those words on the display writer. He had told neither Parker nor Koblenz, because those incidents had transpired after he'd begun drug therapy, and after the drug seemed to be working, and he had not wanted to appear to be slipping backward. Besides, although those two words filled him with dread, he did not understand their significance. He did not know why they had the power to raise goose flesh, and he instinctively felt that it was unwise to mention this development to anyone until he had gotten a better handle on it. He had been afraid Koblenz would conclude that the drugs were not helping him and would discontinue them in favor of psychotherapy. And Dom had needed the drugs. The moon. No one knew. Damn it. No one but Dom himself. In the street lamp's dim glow, he had not checked for a postmark. Now he saw that its point of origin was not a mystery, as was the case with the letter that had come this morning. It was clearly stamped New York, New York, and dated December 18th, Wednesday of last week. He almost laughed out loud. He was not insane, after all. He was not sending these cryptic messages to himself, could not possibly be sending them, because he had been in Laguna last week. 3,000 miles separated him from the mailbox in which this, and undoubtedly the other, strange message had first been deposited. But who had sent him the notes? And why? Who in New York could know that he was sleepwalking? Or that he had repeatedly typed the moon on his word processor? 1,000 questions crowded Dom Corvaces's mind, and he had no answers to any of them. Worse, at the moment, he could see no way even to seek answers. The situation was so bizarre that there was no logical direction for his inquiries to take. For 2 months, he had thought that his sleepwalking was the strangest and most frightening thing that had ever happened, or ever would happen, to him. But whatever lay behind the somnambulism must be even stranger and more frightening than the nightwalking itself. He recalled the first message he had left for himself on the word processor. I'm afraid. What had he been hiding from in closets? When he had started to nail the windows shut while sound asleep, what had he hoped to keep out of his house? Dom saw now that his sleepwalking had not been caused by stress. He was not suffering anxiety attacks because he feared the success or failure of his first novel. It was nothing as mundane as that. Something else. Something very strange and terrible. What did he know in his sleep that he did not know when awake? Six. New Haven County, Connecticut. The sky had cleared before nightfall, but the moon had not yet risen. The stars shed little light upon the cold earth. With his back against a boulder, Jack Twist sat in the snow atop a knoll at the edge of pines, waiting for the guardmaster armored truck to appear. Only 3 weeks after personally netting more than $1 million from the mafia warehouse job, he was already setting up another heist. He was wearing boots, gloves, and a white ski suit, with the hood over his head and tied securely under his chin. 300 yards behind him, and to the southwest, beyond the small woods, The darkness was relieved by the light of a housing development. However, Jack waited in utter blackness, his breath steaming. In front of him, 2 miles of night-clad fields lay northeast, barren but for a few widely spaced trees and some winter-stripped brush. In the distance beyond the emptiness, there were electronics plants, then shopping centers, then residential neighborhoods, none of which was visible from Jack's position, though their existence was indicated by the glow of electric lights on the horizon. At the far edge of the fields, headlights appeared over a low rise. Raising a pair of night binoculars, Jack focused on the approaching vehicle, which was following the 2-lane county road that bisected the fields. In spite of the leftward cast of his left eye, Jack had superb vision, and with the help of the night binoculars he ascertained that the vehicle was not the guardmaster truck, therefore of no consequence to him. He lowered the glasses. In his solitude upon the snowy knoll, he thought back to another time and a warmer place, to a humid night in a Central American jungle when he had studied a nocturnal landscape with binoculars just like these. Then he had been searching anxiously for hostile troops that had been stalking and encircling him and his buddies. His platoon, 20 highly trained rangers under the leadership of Lieutenant Rafe Eichhorn, with Jack as second in command, had crossed the border illegally and gone 15 miles inside the enemy state without being detected. Their presence could have been construed as an act of war. Therefore, they wore camouflage suits stripped of rank and service markings, and they carried no identification. Their target was a nasty little re-education camp, cynically named the Institute of Brotherhood, where 1,000 Miskito Indians were imprisoned by the People's Army. 2 weeks earlier, courageous Catholic priests had led another 1,500 Indians through the jungles and out of the country before they could be imprisoned, too. These clergymen had brought word that the Indians at the Institute would be murdered and buried in mass graves if not rescued within the month. The Miskitos were a fiercely proud breed with a rich culture that they refused to forsake for the anti-ethnic, collectivist philosophy of the country's latest leaders. The Indians' continued loyalty to their own traditions would ensure their extermination, for the ruling council did not hesitate to call up the firing squads to solidify its power. Nevertheless, 20 rangers in mufti would not have been committed to such a dangerous raid merely to save Miskitos. Both left and right-wing dictatorial regimes routinely slaughtered their citizenry in every corner of the world, and the United States did not, could not, prevent those state-sanctioned murders. But in addition to the Indians at the Institute, there were 11 others whose rescue, along with the Indians, made the risky operation worthwhile. Those 11 were former revolutionaries who had fought the just war against the now-deposed right-wing dictator, but who had refused to remain silent when their revolution had been betrayed by totalitarians of the left. Undoubtedly, those 11 possessed valuable information. The opportunity to debrief them was more important than saving the lives of 1,000 Indians, at least as far as Washington was concerned. Undetected, Jack's platoon reached the Institute of Brotherhood in a farming district at the edge of the jungle. It was a concentration camp, in all but name, a place of barbed wire fences and guard towers. 2 buildings stood outside the fenced perimeter of the camp, a 2-story concrete block structure from which the government administered the district, and a dilapidated wooden barracks housing 60 troops. Shortly after midnight, the platoon of rangers stealthily took up positions and launched a rocket attack on the barracks and the concrete building. The initial artillery barrages were followed by hand-to-hand combat. 1/2 hour after the last shot was fired, the Indians and other prisoners, as jubilant a group as Jack had ever seen, were formed into a column and moved out toward the border 15 miles away. 2 rangers had been killed, 3 were wounded. As first in command of the platoon, Rafe Eichhorn led the exodus and oversaw security along the column's flanks, while Jack stayed behind with three men to be sure the last of the prisoners got out of the camp in orderly fashion. It was also his responsibility to gather up files relating to the interrogation, torture, and murder of Indians and district peasants. By the time he and his four men left the Institute of Brotherhood, they were 2 miles behind the last of the Miskitos. Though Jack and his men made good time, they never caught up with their platoon, and were still miles from the Honduran border when, at dawn, hostile army helicopters like giant black wasps came in low over the trees and began offloading enemy troops wherever a clearing could be found. The other rangers and all the Indians reached freedom, but Jack and his three men were captured and transported to a facility similar to the Institute of Brotherhood. However, the place was so much worse than the concentration camp that it had no official existence. The ruling council did not admit that such a hellhole existed in the new workers' paradise, or that monstrous inquisitions were conducted within its walls. In true Orwellian tradition, because the four-story complex of cells and torture chambers had no name, it did not exist. Within those nameless walls, in cells without numbers, Jack Twist and the three other rangers were subjected to psychological and physical torture, relentless humiliation and degradation, controlled starvation, and constant threats of death. One of the four died. One went mad. Only Jack and his closest friend, Oscar Weston, held on to both life and sanity during the 11.5 months of their incarceration. Now, 8 years later, leaning against a boulder atop a knoll in Connecticut, waiting for the guardmaster Chuck, Jack heard sounds and detected odors which were not of this wind-swept winter night. The hard footfalls of jackboots on concrete corridors, the stench from the overflowing slops bucket, which was the cell's only toilet, the pathetic cry of some poor bastard being taken from his cell to another session with interrogators. Jack took deep breaths of the clean, cold Connecticut air. He was seldom troubled by bad memories of that time and nameless place. He was more often haunted by what had happened to him after his escape, and by what had happened to his Jenny in his absence. It was not his suffering in Central America that turned him against society. Rather, subsequent events were what had soured him. He saw other headlights out on the black fields and raised his night binoculars. It was the guardmaster, armored transport. He looked at his watch. 9:38. It was right on schedule, as it had been every night for a week. Even with the holiday tomorrow, the truck kept to its route. Guardmaster security was nothing if not reliable. On the ground beside Jack was an attaché case. He lifted the lid. The blue numerals of a digital scanner were locked on the guardmaster's open radio link to the company dispatcher. Even with his state-of-the-art equipment, he had needed 3 nights to discover the truck's frequency. He turned the volume dial on his own receiver. Static crackled, hissed. Then he was rewarded by a routine exchange between the driver and the distant dispatcher.
301,
the dispatcher said.
Reindeer,
the driver said.
Rudolph,
the dispatcher said.
Rooftop,
the driver said. The hiss and crackle of static settled in once more. The dispatcher had opened the exchange with the truck's number, and the rest of it had been the day's code, which served as confirmation that 301 was on schedule and in no trouble of any kind. Jack switched off his receiver. The lighted dials went dark. The armored transport passed less than 200 feet from his position on the knoll, and he turned to watch its dwindling taillights. He was confident of Guardmaster 301's schedule now, and he would not be returning to these fields until the night of the stick-up, which was tentatively scheduled for Saturday, January 11th. Meanwhile, there was a great deal more planning to be done. Ordinarily, planning a job was nearly as exciting and satisfying as the actual commission of the crime.
But as he left the knoll and headed toward the houses to the southwest, where he had parked his car on a quiet street, he felt no elation, no thrill. He was losing the ability to take delight in even the contemplation of a crime. He was changing, and he did not know why. As he drew near the first houses to the southwest of the knoll, he became aware that the night had grown brighter. He looked up. The moon swelled fat on the horizon, so huge it seemed to be crashing to earth, an illusion of enormousness created by the odd perspective of the early stages of the satellite's ascension. He stopped abruptly and stood with his head tilted back, staring up at the luminous lunar surface. A chill seized him, an inner iciness unrelated to the winter cold.
"The moon," he said softly.
Hearing himself speak those words aloud, Jack shuddered violently. Inexplicable fear welled in him. He was gripped by an irrational urge to run and hide from the moon, as if its luminescence were corrosive and would, like an acid, dissolve him as he stood bathed in it. The compulsion to flee passed in a minute. He could not understand why the moon had so suddenly terrified him. It was only the ancient and familiar moon of love songs and romantic poetry. Strange. He headed toward the car again. The looming lunar face still made him uneasy, and several times he glanced up at it, perplexed. However, by the time he got in the car, drove into New Haven, and picked up Interstate 95, that curious incident had faded from his mind. He was once more preoccupied with thoughts of Jenny, his comatose wife, whose condition haunted him more than usual at Christmas time. Later, in his apartment, as he stood by a big window staring out at the great city, a bottle of Beck's in one hand, he was sure that from 261st Street to Park Row, from Bensonhurst to Little Neck, there could be no one in the metropolis whose Christmas Eve was lonelier than his. Seven. Christmas Day. Elko County, Nevada. Sandy Sarver woke soon after dawn came to the high plains. The early sun glimmered vaguely at the bedroom windows of the house trailer. The world was so still that it seemed time must have stopped. She could turn over and go back to sleep if she so desired, for she had 8 more days of vacation ahead of her. Ernie and Fay Block had closed the Tranquility Motel and had gone to visit their grandchildren in Milwaukee. The adjacent Tranquility Grill, which Sandy operated with her husband Ned, was also closed over the holidays. But Sandy knew she could not get back to sleep, for she was wide awake and horny. She stretched like a cat beneath the blankets. She wanted to wake Ned, smother him with kisses, and pull him atop her. Ned was merely a shadowy form in the dark bedroom, breathing deeply, sound asleep. Although she wanted him badly, she did not wake him. There would be plenty of time for lovemaking later in the day. She slipped quietly out of bed, into the bathroom, and showered. She made the end of it a cold shower. For years she had been uninterested in sex. Frigid. Not long ago, the sight of her own nude body had embarrassed her and filled her with shame. Although she did not know the reason for the new feelings that had risen in her lately, she definitely had changed. It had started the summer before last, when sex had suddenly seemed, well, appealing. That sounded silly now. Of course, sex was appealing. But prior to that summer, lovemaking had always been a chore to be endured. Her late erotic blossoming was a delightful surprise and an inexplicable mystery. Nude, she returned to the shadowy bedroom. She took a sweater and a pair of jeans from the closet and dressed. In the small kitchen, she started to pour orange juice, but stopped when stricken by the urge to go for a drive. She left a note for Ned, put on a sheepskin-lined jacket, and went outside to the Ford pickup. Sex and driving were the two new passions in her life, and the latter was almost as important to her as the former. That was another funny thing. Until the summer before last, she hated going anywhere in the pickup except to work and back, and she seldom drove. She had not only disliked highway travel, but had dreaded it the way some people were afraid of airplanes. But now, other than sex, there was nothing she liked better than to get behind the wheel of the truck and take off, journeying on a whim without a destination, speeding. She had always understood why sex repelled her. That had been no mystery. She could blame her father, Horton Purney, for her frigidity. Though she had never known her mother, who had died giving birth, Sandy had known her father far too well. They had lived in a ramshackle house on the outskirts of Barstow, on the edge of the lonely California desert, just the two of them, and Sandy's earliest memories were of sexual abuse. Horton Purney had been a moody, brooding, mean, and dangerous man. Until Sandy escaped from home at 14, her father had used her as if she had been an erotic toy. Only recently had she realized that her strong dislike for highway travel was also related to something else that her father had done to her. Horton Purney had run a motorcycle repair shop out of a sagging, sun-scorched, unpainted barn on the same property as his house, but he had never made much money from it. Therefore, twice a year, he put Sandy in the car and made the 2.5-hour drive across the desert to Las Vegas, where he knew an enterprising pimp, Samson Cherrick. Cherrick had a list of perverts with a special interest in children, and he was always happy to see Sandy. After a few weeks in Vegas, Sandy's father packed, put Sandy in the car, and drove back to Barstow, his pockets bulging with cash. For Sandy, the long drive to Vegas was a nightmare journey, for she knew what awaited her at their destination. The trip back to Barstow was worse, for it was not an escape from Vegas, but a return to the grim life in that ramshackle house and the dark, urgent, insatiable lust of Horton Purney. In either direction, the road had led to hell, and she had learned to loathe the rumble of the car's engine, the hum of tires on the pavement, and the unspooling highway ahead. Therefore, the pleasure she now took from driving and sex seemed miraculous. She could not understand where she had found the strength and will to overcome her horrible past. Since the summer before last, she simply changed, was still changing. And oh, it was glorious to feel the chains of self-loathing and the bonds of fear breaking apart, to feel self-respect for the first time in her life, to feel free. Now she got into the Ford pickup and started the engine. Their house trailer was set on an unlandscaped half-acre lot at the southern edge of the tiny, almost non-existent town of Beowawe, along Route 21, a two-lane blacktop. As Sandy drove away from the trailer, there seemed to be nothing but empty plains, rolling hills, scattered buttes, rocky outcroppings, grass, brush, and waterless arroyos for 1,000 miles in every direction. The intensely blue morning sky was immense, and as she got the Ford up to speed, Sandy felt as if she might take flight. If she headed north on 21, she would pass through Beowawe and soon come to Interstate 80, which led east toward Elko, or west toward Battle Mountain. Instead, she went south, into a beautifully barren landscape. With skill and ease, she guided the four-wheel drive pickup over the badly weathered county road at 70 miles an hour. In 15 minutes, Route 21 petered out into a gravel roadbed that led south through another 83 miles of uninhabited and desolate territory. She did not follow it, choosing instead to turn east on a one-lane dirt track flanked by wild grass and scrub. Some snow lay on the ground this Christmas morning, though not much. In the distance, the mountains were white, but down here the annual precipitation was less than 15 inches a year, little of it in the form of snow. Here was an inch-deep skin of snow, there a small hillock against which a shallow drift had formed, and here a sparkling bush on which wind-driven snow had hardened into a lacy garment of ice. But by far the largest portion of the land was bare and dry and brown. Sandy drove fast on the dirt, too, and behind her a cloud of dust plumed up. In time she left the track, headed overland, north, then west, coming at last to a familiar place, though she had not set out with this destination in mind. For reasons she did not understand, her subconscious often guided her to this spot during her solitary drives, seldom in a direct line, but by wandering routes, so her arrival was usually a surprise to her. She stopped, set the brake. With the engine idling, she stared for a while through the dusty windshield. She came here because it made her feel better, though she did not know why. The slopes, the spines and teeth of rock, the grass and brush, formed a pleasing picture, though the scene was no prettier and no different from thousands of other places nearby. Yet here she felt a sublime peacefulness that could not be attained anywhere else. She switched off the engine and got out of the pickup, and for a while she strolled back and forth, hands jammed into the pockets of her sheepskin-lined jacket, oblivious of the stingingly cold air. Her drive through the wildlands had brought her back towards civilization, and Interstate 80 lay only a couple of hundred yards to the north. The occasional roar of a passing truck echoed like a distant dragon's growl, but the holiday traffic was light. Beyond the highway, on the uplands to the northwest, lay the Tranquility Motel and Grill. But Sandy glanced just once in that direction. She was more interested in the immediate terrain, which exerted a mysterious and powerful attraction for her, and which seemed to radiate peace the way a rock, in evening, radiated the heat of the sun that it had absorbed during the day. She wasn't trying to analyze her affinity for this patch of ground. Evidently there was some subtle harmony in the contours of the land, an interplay of line, form, and shadow that defied definition. Any attempt to decode its attraction would be as foolish as trying to analyze the beauty of a sunset or the appeal of a favorite flower. That Christmas morning, Sandy did not yet know that Ernie Block had been drawn, as if possessed, to the same patch of ground on December 10th, when he had been on his way home from the freight office in Elko. She did not know that it aroused in Ernie an electrifying sense of pending epiphany and more than a little fear, emotions quite unlike those that had stirred in her. Weeks would pass before she learned that her special retreat had a strong attraction for others besides herself, both friends and strangers. Chicago, Illinois. Her father, Stefan Vikazik, that stocky Polish dynamo, rector of St. Bernadette's, rescuer of troubled priests, it was the busiest Christmas morning he had ever known, and as the day wore on, it swiftly became the most meaningful Christmas of his life. He celebrated the second Mass at St. Bernadette's, spent an hour greeting parishioners who stopped by the rectory with fruit baskets and boxes of homemade cookies and other gifts, then drove to University Hospital to pay a visit to Winton Toke, the policeman who had been shot in an uptown sandwich shop yesterday afternoon. Following emergency surgery, Toke had been in the intensive care unit yesterday afternoon and all through the night. Christmas morning, he had been moved to a semi-private room adjacent to the ICU, for although he was no longer in critical condition, he still needed to be monitored constantly. When Father Vikazik arrived, Raynella Toke, Winton's wife, was at her husband's bedside. She was quite attractive, with chocolate-brown skin and stylish, close-cropped hair. "Mrs. Toke, I'm Stefan Vikazik."
"But..."
he smiled.
"Relax. I'm not here to give anyone the last rites."
"Good,"
Winton said, "because I'm sure not planning on dying."
The wounded policeman was not only fully conscious, but alert, and apparently suffering no pain. His bed was raised to a sitting position. Although his broad chest was heavily bandaged, and although a cardiac telemetry device hung around his neck, and in spite of the IV line that was dripping glucose and antibiotics into the median basilic vein in his left arm, he looked remarkably well, considering his recent misadventure. Father Vikazik stood at the foot of the bed, his tension betrayed only by the way he kept turning his black fedora around and around in his strong hands. When he realized what he was doing, he quickly put the hat on a chair. He said,
"Mr. Tok, if you feel up to it, I've come to ask you a few questions about what happened yesterday."
Both Tok and his wife looked puzzled by Stefan's curiosity. The priest gave a partial explanation for his interest, though only partial.
"The fellow who cruised the uptown district with you for the past week, Brendan Cronin, was in my employ," he said, maintaining Brendan's cover as a lay worker for the church.
"Oh, I'd like to meet him," Raynello said, her face brightening.
"He saved my life," Tolk said. "He did a crazy brave thing, which he shouldn't have done in a million years, but I'm sure glad he did it."
Raynello said, "Mr. Cronin walked into that sandwich shop not knowing if all the gunmen were dead, not knowing if he might be shot."
"It's strictly against police procedure to walk into a situation like that," Winton said. "I'd have handled it by the book myself if I'd been one of those outside. I can't exactly applaud what Brendan did, Father, but I owe him my life for doing it."
"Amazing," Father Vikazik said, as if this were the first time he had heard of Brendan's bravery. In fact, yesterday he had spoken at length with Winton Toke's precinct captain, an old friend, and had heard Brendan praised for courage and damned for foolishness.
"I've always known Brendan's a dependable fellow. Did he also provide first aid?"
"He might have," Winton said.
"Don't really know. I remember regaining consciousness, and there he was, sort of looming over me, calling my name. But I was still in a haze, you see."
"It's a miracle Wynne survived," Raynello said in a tremulous voice.
Now, honey," Winton said softly. "I did make it, and that's all that counts."
When he was sure his wife would be all right, he looked at Stefan and said,
"Everyone's amazed that I could lose so much blood and pull through. From what I hear, I must have lost buckets. Did Brendan apply a tourniquet?"
Tok frowned.
"Don't know. Like I said, I was in a haze. A daze."
Father Vikazik hesitated, wondering how to find out what he needed to know without revealing the extraordinary possibility that motivated this visit. "I know you're not very clear about what happened, but did you notice anything peculiar about Brendan's hands?"
"Peculiar? What do you mean?"
"He touched you, didn't he?"
"Sure. I guess he felt for a pulse, then checked around to see where the bleeding was coming from." "Well, did you feel anything? Anything unusual when he touched you? Anything odd?"
Stefan asked carefully, frustrated by the need to be vague.
I don't seem to be following your line of thought, Father."
Stefan Vikazik shook his head.
"Never mind. The important thing is that you're well."
He glanced at his watch and, feigning surprise, said,
"Good heavens, I'm late for an appointment."
Before they could respond, he snatched his hat from the chair, wished them Godspeed, and hurried out, no doubt leaving them astonished by his behavior. When people saw Father Vikazik walking toward them, they were usually reminded of drill sergeants or football coaches. His solid body and the self-confident, aggressive way he used it were not what one expected of a priest, and when he was in a hurry, he was not so much like a drill sergeant or a football coach as he was like a tank. From Tok's room, Father Vikazik blitzed down the hall, shoved through a pair of heavy swinging doors, then through another pair into the intensive care unit, where the wounded policeman had been until just an hour ago. He asked to speak to the physician on duty, Dr. Royce Albright.
with the hope that God would forgive a few little white lies told in a good cause. Stefan identified himself as the Toke family's priest and implied that Mrs. Toke had sent him to get the full story of her husband's condition, about which she was not yet entirely clear. Dr. Albright looked like Jerry Lewis and had a deep, rumbling voice like Henry Kissinger, which was disconcerting. But he was willing to answer whatever questions Father Vikazic wished to pose. He was not Winton Toke's personal physician, but he was interested in the case.
"You can assure Mrs. Toke that there's almost no danger of a setback. He's coming along marvelously. Shot twice in the chest, point blank with a 38. Until yesterday, no one here would have believed that anyone could take two shots in the chest from a large caliber handgun and be out of intensive care in 24 hours. Ooh. Mr. Toke is incredibly lucky."
"The bullets miss the heart, then, and all vital organs?"
"Not only that," Albright said, "but neither round did major damage to any veins or arteries. A 38 caliber slug has lots of punch, Father. Ordinarily, it chews up the victim. In Toke's case, one major artery and vein were nicked, but neither was severed. Very fortunate, indeed."
"Then, I suppose the bullet was stopped by bone at some point."
"Deflected, yes, but not stopped. Both slugs were found in soft tissue. And that's another amazing thing. No shattered bones. Not even a small fracture. A very lucky man."
Father Vikazic nodded. "When the two slugs were removed from his body, was there any indication they were underweight for 38 caliber ammunition? I mean, maybe the cartridges were faulty with too little lead in the bullets. That would explain why, even though it was a 38 revolver, the shots did less damage than a pair of 22s. Albright frowned.
"Don't know. Could be. You'd have to ask the police. Or Dr. Sonneford, the surgeon who took the slugs out of Toke."
"I understand Officer Toke lost a great deal of blood." Grimacing, Albright said,
"Must be a mistake about that on his chart. I haven't had a chance to talk to Dr. Sonneford today, it being Christmas. But according to the chart, Toke received over 4 liters of whole blood in the operating room. Of course, that can't be correct."
"Why not?"
"Father, if Toke actually lost 4 liters of blood before they got him to the hospital, there wouldn't be enough in him to maintain even minimal circulation. He'd have been dead. Stone cold dead."
Las Vegas, Nevada. Mary and Pete Monatella, George's parents, arrived at her apartment at 6 on Christmas morning, bleary-eyed and grumpy from too little sleep, but determined to take up their rightful posts by the brightly trimmed tree before Marcy awoke. Mary, as tall as Georgia, had once been almost as shapely as her daughter, too. Now she was heavy, girdled. Pete was shorter than his wife, barrel-chested, a bantam rooster who seemed to strut when he walked, but was one of the most self-effacing men Georgia had ever known. They came burdened with presents for their only grandchild. They had a present for Georgia, plus the usual gifts they brought every time they visited, well-meant but annoying criticism, unwanted advice, guilt. Mary was hardly through the door before she announced that Georgia should clean the ventilation hood above the range, and she rummaged under the sink until she found a spray bottle of Windex and a rag, with which she performed the chore herself. She also observed that the tree looked under-decorated.
"It needs more lights, Georgia."
And when she saw how Marcy's presents were wrapped, she professed despair.
"My God, Georgia! The wrapping papers aren't bright enough. The ribbons aren't big enough. Little girls like bright papers with Santa Claus on them, and lots of ribbons."
For his part, her father was content to focus all of his discontent upon the huge tray of cookies on the kitchen counter.
"These are all store-bought, Georgia. Didn't you make any homemade cookies this year?" "Well, Dad, I've been working a little overtime lately, And then there are the classes I'm taking at UNLV, and I know it's hard being a single mother, baby, he said. But we're talking fundamentals here. Homemade cookies are one of the best parts of Christmas. It's an absolute fundamental.
Fundamental, George's mother agreed.
The Christmas spirit had been late in coming to Georgia this year, and even now she had a tenuous grip on it. Subject to her parents' well-intentioned but infuriating non-stop commentary on her shortcomings, she might have lost the holiday mood altogether if Marcy had not put in a timely appearance at 6:30, just after Georgia had slipped a 14-pound turkey into the oven for the big meal later in the day. The girl shuffled into the living room in her pajamas, as cute as any idealized child in a Norman Rockwell painting.
"Did Santa bring my little Miss Doctor kit?"
Pete said.
"He brought you more than that, Pumpkin. Look here, just look at all Santa brought."
Marcy turned and saw the tree, which Santa had put up during the night, and the mountain of gifts. She gasped.
"Wow!"
The child's excitement was transmitted to George's parents, and for the time being, they forgot about such things as dusty ventilation hoods and store-bought cookies. For a while, the apartment was filled with joyous, busy sounds. But by the time Marcy had opened half her gifts, the celebratory mood began to change, and in crept a little of the darkness that would reappear in a far more frightening form later in the day. In a whiny voice that was out of character, the girl grumped that Santa had not remembered the little Miss Doctor kit. She discarded a much-wanted doll without even taking it out of its box, moving to the next package in the hope that it contained little Miss Doctor, clawing at the wrappings. Something in the child's demeanor, a queerness in her eyes, disquieted Georgia. Soon Mary and Pete noticed it as well. They began urging Marcy to take more time with each present, to get more pleasure out of each before rushing on to the next, but their entreaties were not successful. Georgia had not put the doctor play kit under the tree. It was hidden in a closet as a final surprise. But with only three boxes left, Marcy was pale and trembling in anticipation of little Miss Doctor. In God's name, what was so important about it? Many of the toys already unwrapped were more expensive and more interesting than the play doctor's bag. Why was her attention so intently and unnaturally focused on that single item? Why was she so obsessed with it? When the last of the gifts beneath the tree and the last of those from Mary and Pete were opened, Marcy let out a sob of purest misery.
"Santa didn't bring it! He forgot! He forgot!"
Considering all the wondrous presents strewn across the room, the girl's despondency was shocking. Georgia was disconcerted and displeased by Marcy's rudeness, and she saw that her own parents were startled, dismayed, and impatient with this unexpected and unjustified tantrum. Suddenly afraid that Christmas was collapsing into ruins around her, Georgia ran to the bedroom closet, plucked the crucial gift from behind the shoeboxes, and returned to the living room with it. With frenzied desperation, Marcy snatched the box from her mother.
"What's gotten into the child?" Mary asked.
"Yeah," Pete said. "What's so important about this little doctor?"
Marcy tore frantically at the wrappings until she saw that the package contained the item she most desired. Immediately, she grew calm, stopped trembling.
"Little Miss Doctor, Santa didn't forget."
"Honey, maybe it's not from Santa," Georgia said.
She was relieved to see the child she loved emerging from that strange and unpleasant mood.
"Not all your gifts came from Santa. Better look at the tag."
Marcy dutifully searched for the tag, read the few words on it, and looked up with an uncertain smile.
"It's from Daddy."
Georgia felt her parents staring at her, but she did not meet their eyes. They knew that Alan had gone off to Acapulco with his latest bimbo, the airhead blonde named Pepper, and that he had not bothered to leave so much as a card for Marcy, and they no doubt disapproved of Georgia letting him off the hook like this. Later, When Georgia was in the kitchen, squatting in front of the oven, checking on the turkey, her mother stooped down beside her and said softly,
"Why'd you do it, Georgia? Why'd you put that louse's name on the gift she wanted most of all?"
Georgia slid the rack partway out of the oven, bringing the turkey into the light. With a ladle, she scooped the drippings from the pan and basted the roasting bird. Finally, she said,
"Marcy shouldn't have a Christmas ruined just because her father's a jackass." "You shouldn't protect her from the truth," Mary said quietly.
"The truth's too ugly for a 7-year-old.
The sooner she knows what allows her father is, the better. You know what your dad heard about this woman Alan's living with?"
"I sure hope this bird's going to be done by noon."
Mary would not drop the subject.
"She's on the call list of 2 casinos, Georgia. That's what Pete heard. You know what I mean? She's a call girl. Alan's living with a call girl. What's wrong with him?"
Georgia closed her eyes and took a deep breath. Mary said,
"Well, if he wants nothing to do with Marcy, that's fine. God knows what diseases he's picked up living with that woman."
Georgia pushed the turkey back into the oven, closed the door, and stood up.
"Could we not talk about this anymore? I thought you'd want to know what the woman is. So now I know."
Their voices dropped lower, became more intense.
"What if he comes around someday and says, 'Pepper and I want Marcy to go to Acapulco with us, or Disneyland, or maybe just stay at their place for a while?'"
Exasperated, Georgia said,
"Mother, he doesn't want anything to do with Marcy because she reminds him of his responsibilities. But what if..." "Mother, damn it!"
Although Georgia had not raised her voice, there was such anger in those 3 words that the effect on her mother was immediate. A hurt look crossed Mary's face. Stung, she turned away from Georgia. She went quickly to the refrigerator, opened it, and looked over the contents of the overloaded shelves.
"Oh, you made gnocchi." "Not store-bought," Georgia said shakily. "Homemade."
She meant to be conciliatory, but she realized that her comment might be misconstrued as a snide reference to her father's dismay over store-bought cookies. She bit her lip and fought back scalding tears. Still looking into the refrigerator, a tremor still in her voice, Mary said,
"You're going to have potatoes, too. And what's this? Oh, you've already grated the cabbage for coleslaw. I thought you'd need help, but I guess you've thought of everything."
She closed the refrigerator door and looked for something she could do to occupy her and get them through this awkward moment. Tears were visible in her eyes. Georgia virtually flung herself away from the counter and threw her arms around her mother. Mary returned the hug, and for a while they clung to each other, finding speech both unnecessary and impossible. Holding fast, Mary said,
"I don't know why I'm like this. My mother was the same with me. I swore I'd never be like this with you. I love you just the way you are. Maybe it's because you're my only. If I'd been able to have a couple others, I wouldn't be so tough on you. It's partly my fault, Mom. I've been so touchy lately."